Continuing our gender discussion, all things gender related, it's really difficult to talk about the current situation in gender related issues without going back and doing a little bit of history. And so today, while when you think of gender related questions today, feminism is no longer the first item that comes to mind. That's so 1990s, you know, it's like those issues, strange to me, but those issues are now 25 or 30 years old, the stuff that was going on in the 90s. Seems like it was yesterday, but okay, maybe it was yesterday. This is now the old families group, but that's what it is. So, but looking at this historically is going to help us to understand a little bit of what's going on and kind of what's happening in some of the progressive movements in American culture. Not a lot of scripture in today's lesson because we're more looking at how did we get here and what's going on. But next week, Lord willing, we're going to start actually cracking open the Bible and saying, okay, we've got the history, we've got the terms in the first couple of weeks of definitions. Now the question is, what are some of the things? We're going to have one lesson specifically on just what gender issues come up in the Old Testament. When you read the Old Testament, what kind of questions do you have related to gender? And then we're going to have 2 weeks after that on the New Testament, where we're going to try to literally cover every passage in the New Testament that has something to say about gender-related topics. So 3 weeks after this, it's going to get exciting. But today, a history lesson. Most of the information I have on the history section today doesn't come from me. I took it from a feminist website, a group, I forget the name of which group I took it from, but they're trying to explain feminism to a public audience, so it's not something I thought of by any stretch. This is kind of the way that particular group described themselves. The first problem with the word feminism is it's a word, as one of my professors liked to say, that gets up and moves around on you, but it's not clear how to define that term. Historically, there's been at least three distinct waves of feminism in the 20th century. You can go back further than that, but at least three distinct waves in the 20th century, which, as I said, is now the past. We're now moving ahead. And even within those distinct movements, I would go so far as to say this: each of the three ways of feminism has something wonderful and something terrible in it, which is probably true for every social movement that's ever existed, right? There's always something like, well, you got a point there, what is this, right? And that's always kind of the way it plays out. So we'll mention these. The older they are, movement-wise, the more they've kind of had time to become a mainstream accepted part of our culture and heritage. So you say, well, of course they were right, but then you get closer and it's a little more controversial. The first wave of feminism is up through the 1930s, anything that happened in the first 30 years of American civilization in the 20s, or excuse me, in the 20th century. Second wave is the 60s, 70s, and potentially the 80s, but it kind of peters out. And then the third wave is what begins in the 90s, and at some point we're going to have a fourth wave, I assume, to describe what's going on now, but it's kind of hard to define historical terms for the present, right? That's a little too self-aware. But we can say the 1990s was typically thought of as the third wave of feminism. So these are the three kind of movements, and they each had a different set of values and goals. So first wave feminists, prior to the 1930s, they pursued racial and social justice. So these are women who are asking for the right to vote. Like most movements, again, there's goods and bads. Some of the feminists of this movement were deeply Christian women, actually. The early feminists were strongly Christian in some parts of that movement, that were advocating for women who were being abused in home relationships, who were being overlooked in the political arena and so forth and socially. And this is a group that had a lot of concerns about alcohol because it led to abuse, which led to beaten women, right? So that group, a lot of Christian influence in that, a lot of Methodists in the early feminist movement. Other group were devout communists who thought, you know, religion's the problem, let's get rid of it and we'll fix everything. And so you get some of both in that early movement. But if you look at their values, they pursued the right to vote for women, and their crowning achievement, you say, what did they accomplish that they would say they're most proud of, would be the 19th Amendment and women having the right to vote. That part of it, I think everyone looks back and say, yeah, that was overdue, right? That, good. So you say, are you a feminist? You look at this movement and say, well, I'm really glad women have the right to vote. I think it's a good idea. So again, that wave of feminism, you say, I'm impressed. But even in there, if you want to dig down, are there some dark alleys you can go to in that wave of feminism? There are, for sure. But on the whole, I think largely we look back now and say that was long overdue. The 60s, every step forward, you get a little more controversial as to what we think about them. They fought for complete gender equality. So if you want to think of the first wave as legal equality, right? Do we have the rights of a U.S. citizen? The second was for social equality. That is, are we treated as if we have the rights of a U.S. citizen? One, it's good to start to say it on paper. Is it actually true in common practice? So what kind of issues came up there? Social and economic justice. Are a woman and a man being paid the same for the same job? Would be one of the questions. That remains a difficult question for a variety of reasons. And without diving in way too deep, it's not an easy question because there are differences between men and women and things that happen. What's the fundamental difference, if I have to pick one, between men and women? Like the most obvious?
Childbearing.
Right? That affects the story somehow. You can't pretend men and women are biologically equivalent. There is a distinction in what happens in their lifetime. And that does affect, over the course of a person's career, what they're paid. If they go out of the workforce for a period of time to raise children or get back in, that happens. That said, that's not always the problem. Sometimes it's just that people were paying more for a man to do the same job than they were a woman. Sometimes it was just awfulness, okay? So that, again, mixed bag of problems there that continue to this day. I don't remember what the numbers were then. It's still not dollar for dollar equality, and I don't know if dollar for dollar equality is possible in as long as women are having children. Like, that's one of the issues that comes up in that debate. But it's definitely a better number now across the board than it was in the 60s and 70s. So that would be one of the issues they tackled. Focused more on the home and the workplace. What else is going on in the 60s and 70s in terms of
Civil rights.
So we have that going on that's racial related. Okay. What about medical advancements? Yeah, the availability of birth control shifts the equation in ways that it's hard to discuss. Protestants never really got on board the anti-birth control bandwagon. The Catholic Church was devoutly opposed to it. And one of the reasons they said it will change society. It has changed society, right? And not everything about it is good, and not everything about it is bad, right? And so it continues to be a discussion that we probably don't have in church, and we should, is to talk about the repercussions of that. But like any kind of technology, internet, the printing press, birth control changed something. And that's going on at this same time that affects all of these classifications. So the home and the workplace were the big issues there. They split kind of in the 70s into two groups that take different trajectories as a movement. You have equal rights feminist, and then you have a group that becomes what I would describe as more radical and revolutionary feminists. That some were looking for equality, some actually wanted to flip it upside down, and sometimes had a bitterness towards men that came out in their speeches and language, right? And so those take somewhat different trajectories. And sometimes they blend too. So it's hard to describe what happens there, but it's interesting the fallout of that. You can read people from that same movement who don't sound alike, is my point. What are the crowning achievements of that? The page I was looking at, kind of the feminist group describing their history, said probably Title IX and Roe v. Wade as the crowning achievements of that movement. Title IX relating to federal recognition of and educational standards and so forth related to gender. And then Roe v. Wade related to abortion, right? Has to do with reproductive, we usually call it reproductive rights. I have a lot to say about abortion, but this isn't a class on abortion, so I'll leave that for now. But you can see where, even as a feminist, you might have a different opinion on those two topics, especially as a if you consider yourself a Christian feminist. You might say, I'm really glad we have girls' sports. Not as excited about abortion, right? So there are some issues there. There is no such thing as a monolithic movement where everybody's on the same page. But that's kind of what happens in any kind of social movement. Probably the same thing's true of Christianity, right? What do Christians believe in? Go ahead, right? Which one are you talking to is kind of the issue. And then, so the same thing happens with this movement. And then we'll pause for a little discussion here in a minute, but the third movement, third wave, 1990s and so forth, this was really, in my view, motivated by the more radical fringe of the second wave. It's very academic. It's influenced by a lot of people in professorships, heavily influenced by postmodernism, and that particular school of thought is where a lot of it comes from. All of it? No, not all of it. Not by any stretch. But that's where who is doing the speaking in these movements. The first wave, it was Methodist. The third wave, it's professors from Harvard. Okay. So there's a difference in who are the spokesmen of these movements, and that shifts the message somewhat. The word that comes up now in the 90s, I said now, see? Now in the 90s, in feminist literature is intersectionality. And that question is asking the question, who else has been oppressed like we are? And kind of creating a coalition of oppressed persons to recognize inequalities of power. Postmodernism as a philosophy is about inequality of power. So anybody that finds themselves in an unequal position of power is going to be interested in postmodernism. So you have post-colonial, right? If you used to be a colony of a major superpower, we have post-colonial, postmodernism, lots of posts in that. Mm-hmm. You have feminists, you have gender and queer theory. All of those are groups of people that are saying, I am a minority group that's been oppressed in some way. And those groups start to kind of coalesce in this third wave and say, all of us are facing the same struggle. All of us have the same villain. Who's the villain? People who look like me.
Bearded men.
Bearded men, yes. Yeah, white men. White Anglo-Saxon Protestants are a lot of the problem, right? And again, good and bad. Has that been true sometimes? Yeah, it has. White guys haven't always done very good things, okay? A lot of Western civilization has been put into the hands of white men, and we haven't made good decisions, okay? Fair enough. I'm all for that, and we're still not doing great. But that's the kind of combination of issues that is in that third wave that's now kind of peeling apart in our current moment in history. This is a group that's looking for people that have been marginalized, of which there are always many, okay? And how can we speak out for them is the issue.
When you're against uneven power dynamics, if that's one of your stated causes, life is uneven power dynamics. When you take that phrase down to its root, everything about life on Earth is uneven power dynamics.
Yeah.
From a child who has to clean his room because mom said, to rich guy, poor guy, so it's very interesting. The borders of this are fuzzy. You said it's sort of coming apart. I'm not sure if it is or not. I think it's just so indistinct. We can't identify the movement.
One of the interesting voices, and I'm going to use the word interesting, not yes, you should like this person, just one of the interesting voices right now on this topic is Jordan Peterson, who is just an outspoken, he's a clinical psychologist with written some fantastic books in the past in his academic field, right? So he's got chops in his academic world, and he got in trouble at his university in Canada because he objected to the university's policy about pronoun requirements and so forth, and then he became a YouTube sensation, now he's lecturing. But what's interesting about it, he's a non-Christian evolutionary thinking psychologist who says hierarchies are part of our psychology because of evolution. They exist in nature. We can't pretend they don't. There are disparities of power in living systems. And he's been an interesting voice. And like anything else, he says something good, and then you see the Nazis outside that like him, and you're like, eh, I don't know. So it's kind of, you got to decide, is this someone I like or not? But that's, it's a difficult thing. Okay, so feminism and recent questions, how does that relate to the questions we've been trying to get at in this class in particular? And I got to keep going, I'm running out of time. The realization that some persons were treated as less than equal raised the question, who else? Who else is being treated as less than equal, less than person? So same-sex attracted persons saw in feminism a kindred spirit. We're also an underprivileged class. People who do not feel they fit into either male or female categories said, you know, we feel the same way. Let's get on board with that. People who change their gender say, we don't fit into that. We're an underprivileged class. We also have a disparity of power. And so they can. So that's how that set of questions that was specifically about women has kind of connected in its own weird way with what's going on now. And that's the trajectory to help you understand it. Feminism in the church, how does it relate to how we talk about things as a church? There's a historical question that gets pointed at the church a lot. And it goes something like this. You Christian people have been wrong about everything so far in the 20th century, so of course you're wrong about this. So churches supported slavery, and you were wrong. Churches supported segregation, and you were wrong. Churches supported male-dominated society, and you were wrong. Churches supported traditional marriage. See the argument? That what they're saying is, historically, it looks like churches have been on the wrong side of every social question for the last 100 years. So why would we trust you on this one? See the argument? Okay. I don't have a great answer for that right off the bat. Except that history is weird, would be the first thing I'd say. My quick answer would be all of these questions, all these points, are actually more complicated than anybody wants to admit. Every last one of them. Take the first one. Some churches supported slavery, but it was Christian people who were the abolitionists opposed to slavery, right? The reason you can say Christians supported slavery is because at that moment in history, everybody in Western civilization was a Christian. So there were Christians opposed to slavery, and there were Christians supporting slavery. But go Google William Wilberforce and ask yourself if Christians supported slavery or not. Other times we did terrible things. One of the more famous historic earliest Church of Christ in America building is in Kentucky. Near Bethany in West Virginia, is kind of on that little seam there. And there's a balcony with no stairs or ladder. Who is the balcony for? If black folks wanted to climb up there and come to church, they could. Right, but the white folks sat down here. On the one hand, at that moment in history, having a balcony for black folks was kind of progressive. At the same time, you look at it and say, that's terrible. Right? All these stories are complicated, and I don't want to say, gloss over it and say, oh, we're fine, we don't have anything to repent of, but all of it's complicated. Church on gender issues is complicated. We kind of have this idea that it's always been a certain way. It hasn't. Take some time, and do research on gender roles in churches of Christ just in the 20th century. And it's a weird story of back and forth. This is a book, I have a church manual in my office written for Churches of Christ, okay, of how to conduct your worship service. And I was reading the introduction chapter, and it says, it is not necessary that one person should conduct the whole service. The sermon may be read by some bright young brother or sister who has a good voice and who is a ready reader, while the communion service might be led by other older brethren who have good standing in the community, but who might not be able to read the sermon attractively. As a rule, it would be well to enlist as many brothers and sisters as is practical in the leading of the parts of the service. What radical New Age Church of Christ was that? 1904, right? In a church manual published in 1904, you had Standard Publishing saying, well, of course, in Churches of Christ, we have women reading stuff in worship. And then there were, you can go to other decades where I can show you publications that say, absolutely not, we don't do that in Churches of Christ. And then another decade where they say, oh, yeah, we do that. My point is, it's complicated. Like, just historically speaking, what has been normal in Churches of Christ hasn't been the same. So to say, well, you're on the wrong side of these women's issues, which decade? Which Churches of Christ? Which churches? So even that's a little bit complicated. God's Woman by... Yes, C.R. Nickel, literally. So he was a preacher at one point in Seminole, Oklahoma, my hometown. Not while I was there. I'm from the 90s, but I'm not that far back. Anyway, he literally wrote the book. There's a little book they used to give out to new converts that was titled Handbook or Encyclopedia of the Bible or something like that. I can't remember exactly. It was written by C.R. Nickel. He literally wrote the book of what Church of Christ people believed. He had a book in the 30s titled God's Woman. That would be really controversial today because some of the things he said he thought women could do. And there was, and some people disagreed with him and wrote back, and they had arguments about it. But my point is, it's complicated. He was as mainstream as anybody in the Church of Christ and took what even today would be considered pretty progressive views on that. We'll get to what I think in a few weeks. But the point is, Churches of Christ, it's not monolithic. Churches, Protestants, Catholics have not been monolithic. And then another observation I think is worth mentioning is that people that would want to say today they're on the right side of history aren't all on the same side. And this is where I'm going to make the case that there is currently some serious fraying and fracturing going on within what we would have thought of as the progressive community, which would include our feminist, LGBTQ, and you know whoever else is in this big group of these are the progressives in America. I'm going to suggest to you that that group is currently coming undone because traditional feminist ideals from the 90s don't match up with gender identity issues of our current decade. And I have a video to prove it. This is a video from a fascinating forum, of which there have been a couple, at the Heritage Foundation, which is a right-wing, Republican-backed, conservative think tank. And they invited a group of lesbian feminists to come talk at the Heritage Foundation. Okay, why? Because the lesbian feminists couldn't give their talk to progressive because progressive wouldn't let them say what they were about to say. And so it was a marriage made in the Twilight Zone to have these two groups of people together on the same stage talking about current gender issues. It's like an hour long. I snipped about 3 minutes of it that I thought was fascinating.
Good afternoon. My name is Julia Beck. I live in Baltimore City, and I am a lesbian. You might be thinking to yourself, why is a lesbian speaking at the Heritage Foundation? And I ask myself the same thing. But my answer is pretty simple. There is no place for me. I am politically homeless. So believe me when I say I am grateful for the opportunity to share my story. Thank you to the organizers, to my fellow panelists, and everyone here for making this happen. My story is as unbelievable and absurd as it is commonplace. I got kicked off of the Baltimore Mayor's LGBTQ Commission as the only lesbian simply for stating biological facts. After a months-long witch hunt, I was found guilty of violence. My crime? Using male pronouns to talk about a convicted male rapist who identifies as transgender and prefers female pronouns. It doesn't matter that he sexually assaulted two women in a women's prison after being transferred there on account of his gender identity. Oh no, it is far more criminal for me to call a male rapist he than it is for him to rape. The man who led my inquisition also identifies as transgender. He is the president of the Baltimore Transgender Alliance and claims to be a lesbian. I find that almost funny, because everything he does makes life for women, girls, and lesbians worse.
So it's a bizarre story that literally the only L on the LGBTQ commission got kicked off because of something she said about a transgendered inmate who is a male transgender to female rapist who demanded to be transferred to a female correctional facility where he proceeded to molest women. And her crime was saying he is a problem. Right? My point is that movement has issues, right? That's not a monolithic movement where everyone's on the same page. I suspect we're going to continue to see kind of 90s era feminists at odds with the LGBTQ community, including some of the L part of that, because the way they define terms doesn't match up. So take, for example, this young lady. Random picture, I don't know what she thinks about herself, but just go with me a minute. Okay. Imagine a young girl who likes boy things and tells her parents she's attracted to other girls. Okay. A lesbian feminist would say this is a female lesbian, right, and should be treated and honored that way. A transgendered activist says this is a boy trapped in a female's body. And those are two fundamentally different answers to that question, right? If you go read the rest, or listen to the rest of that audio, hour-long conversation, some of the others say, we wrote books and we built a whole philosophy around defending what it means to be a woman who likes women, and now you're saying that's not a thing, actually we're in the wrong body. And there is a huge clash of identities and values there in that movement. It's going to be very interesting what happens to Title IX and related programs like that with this. The crowning achievement of third wave feminism doesn't work in the current movement of gender identity. It doesn't match up. And it's going to be an issue all you guys in sports enjoy. That's going to be something special. I don't know what happens to women's sports in the future. It's very interesting. Feminism in the Bible, got 10 minutes. What do we do now? Okay. What would I say as, is there any value to reading the Bible with a feminist point of view, or is that something I keep as far away from the Bible as possible? And like everything else I've said today, you got two answers, okay? There are three, actually. There are three schools of thought among feminist Bible interpreters that are very different from each other. Some would say, look, you read the Bible, it demeans women. And so we need to simply reject the Bible and question it, because there's no way you can read the Bible and come to a feminist conclusion. Okay, that's one school of thought, very vocal. Second, the Bible must be interpreted in a way that creates complete gender equality, even if those interpretations are sometimes creative. So they would say, the God of the Bible's on our side. Sometimes the people who wrote the Bible aren't, but you can interpret it in such a way to arrive at feminist conclusions. So that's kind of an in-between position. And the third position is, actually, the Bible does affirm a kind of equality, if understood fairly, but we have to define things like equality and so forth and decide what that means. And then we're going to have to deal with those passages that the first group said, that passage just looks like it demeans women. What do we do about those? Right. Next week, Old Testament on women's issues. What do you do about the passage that talks about how the victim of a rape should marry her rapist? That's an Old Testament rule. That doesn't sound like something I want to tell young women. Okay. Third group says, there's a way to read that that says, actually, there's equality there. You just have to understand its context and what's going on. Those are three very different interpretations of how to take the questions of feminism and read the Bible with them. My conclusions go something like this. And I wrote a paper on it and made Carolyn proof it for me, so it's at least spelled right. There's good things that come out of feminist reading of the Bible. And I'll give you a couple examples. Gender and experience do influence how you read the Bible. Feminists have reminded us men and women read the Bible differently. It's true. Okay. Chemicals in our brain are not identical. We have different set of experiences that we bring to the text. And women reading the Bible notice things and see things that men reading the Bible don't notice and see. That's just true. That shouldn't frighten me. Right? That should be something I embrace and say, God made men and women and wanted them both to read the Bible. And so in class discussions, we try to encourage everyone. I want to hear what you have to say. Bible often has been interpreted in a male-centric manner. Who wrote the commentaries in the Bible through the last 2,000 years? Men. So whose issues come up the most? Women, obviously. No, I mean, fair enough. That's a fair observation, right? The great Bible interpreters through history have been men, and so it's worth noting who gets kind of the short end of the stick in terms of page count. Female characters aren't covered as much in commentaries and books. There aren't nearly as many books about Esther, even though she gets a whole book of the Bible. Ruth, who gets a whole book of the Bible, right? But we're going to talk more about obscure male characters than we would them, because we're male writers, and David makes more sense to me than Esther, because I'm a guy, right? So fair enough. I think those are valuable contributions that feminist interpreters have brought to our attention. The book of Judges is a wonderful test case, if I had another hour. I've done a lot of work in Judges, of how do you read the book of Judges with women's issues in mind. But there's a couple of really strong female characters at the beginning of the book, say Deborah. At the end of the book, we have a concubine getting cut in half and chopped off and sent to other people in Israel, and then people getting kidnapped and pressed into marriage, right? There's some very interesting things going on in that story related to women. A lot of the commentaries written by men tried to justify it and say, well, it kind of makes sense if you understood how they did things. Kidnapping women and marrying them doesn't make sense, right? There's no point in history where you said, well, yeah, it was normal. It's not good, okay? So fair enough. We need to read it and say, how would a woman feel about this? How does a woman feel about the story of Hagar? Brought as a slave out of Egypt. Sarah says, bear Abraham a son. We need a son. And then she does. And Sarah says, all right, now get out. That's a sad story for a woman. We usually talk about Abraham and not Hagar. Why? Because I'm a man and I understand Abraham. Okay, fair enough. Okay, what's the bad from feminist readings? The feminist ideal becomes privileged over the Bible itself and the author's intent. Sometimes the feminist interpreter finds what they want in a text. It happens. One of the papers that I studied for the paper I wrote was essentially argued that God more or less raped Mary in order to bring about Jesus. That it, the power dynamic involved in the virgin birth of Jesus was the equivalent of rape. It's an interesting point of view. You didn't get that from Luke, right? It's just something that in your mind made sense. And as one of my professors used to say, everybody got to get published somehow. You know? Yeah, sure, if you want to publish the title of the paper, and I had to request this from the poor librarian at Midwestern, I need a copy of Behold the Lord's Whore. And she goes, oh, really? Yep, I'm writing a paper. And she goes, okay. And so she got it for me. Anyway, that's an example of someone putting what they wanted to see into a text that was never there, and that's hurtful to any text. And then every male character and every male interpreter becomes untrustworthy if you take that point of view. Where you just said, yeah, well, that's Paul. He did write a big chunk of the Bible under the direction of the Holy Spirit. You can't just throw him out because he's a male.
The social justice warrior's head is to disqualify the authority of Scripture.
Yeah. That's one of the, to me, the major question. The biggest issue on number two, and I'll say this and conclude, there's at least one really important male character in the Bible that I don't get to dismiss. Anybody know his name? Jesus of Nazareth. I don't know why God made our Savior a male, but he did. Just like he made his mother a female, right? That was God's choice to do it that way. I don't get to disqualify Jesus because he doesn't fit into my paradigm of how people should act. On the other hand, one of the most prominent feminist Bible interpreters of the last couple of decades is Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza. She was the first female president of the Society of Biblical Literature and a professor at Harvard. And when I was writing that paper, I came across this statement. A feminist theologian must question whether the historical man Jesus of Nazareth can be a role model for contemporary women, since feminist psychological liberation means exactly the struggle of women to free themselves from all male internalized norms and models. So, are there some values of reading the Bible with a feminist mindset of asking questions about women and being concerned about that? Yeah, I really do think so. If that leads you to where you say, I don't trust Jesus anymore because he's a man, we've arrived at a very bad place. And so I think we have to have some discernment about that particular set of issues and questions. But for our questions in this course, the issue is, how has that led to our current moment in history and how does that connect? And it's both connected and now kind of frayed of the they're not going to get along in the same tent very well. Thoughts or questions?
It's interesting because to that comment, I would say Jesus, the way he treated women and the way he opened the door for women was revolutionary.
If you read the book of Luke, the Gospel of Luke goes out of its way to highlight every minor and major character, female character in the life of Jesus, to make a point of the way he interacted with them. John's Gospel and the Samaritan woman does the same thing. Over and over again, Jesus demonstrates a revolutionary view of women for its time and place. ultimately funded his ministry, right? Yeah. Judas held the bag, but it was women who put the money in it. And then throughout church history, one of my favorite memes is a bunch of nuns laughing, and the caption says, "The Catholic Church oppresses women." And my point is that throughout church history, who has been in the pews? Disproportionately women. And so, yeah, is there some male hierarchy issues in church history we ought to talk about? Yeah, sure is. But Christian history is made up of women, faithful women, like more than 50%, more than 60%. Go out in the auditorium and do a head count, right?
Even though Jesus was a man, the God-bearer was a woman. You know, yeah. What I mean?
And that was my biggest complaint about Behold the Lord's Whore. How do you get a religion that almost deitized Mary, like that actually went to the extreme in the early years of worshiping Mary, and say, yeah, Bible pretty well demonizes women. So, not Mary, apparently. Catholics ended up praying to her and still do. So anyway, okay, that's all the time we got. Thanks for your attention and comments. Next week, Old Testament passages on women.